are, in the whole scheme of things, not that important. And many of the decisions that we make in life are not irreversible. But when it comes to the choice of who we're going to marry, I can't think of another decision that we'll make in this life, and a decision of an earthly nature that's going to impact our lives more than that one. There really probably isn't any area of our life that'll be more affected by any other decision that we'll have to make. From perhaps our emotional stability and well-being to the whole financial underpinning of our lives from that point on, the spirituality with which we desire to live in this world, and everything else we could probably think of relative to life itself is somehow going to be touched by the person that we choose to marry. The only person that didn't have to worry about that, at least from the male side of things, is Adam. You ever stopped and thought about the fact that Adam's first main experience in life was major surgery? Welcome to the world, Adam. And the more I thought about the process of searching for a mate, the more I wonder if major surgery is not an adequate trade-off for not having to look. It is, at times, a painful process. It's a process, it's a search, it's a deliberation that is challenging on every hand. Whatever care we make in making this decision, there's still an element of chance. There's an element of uncertainty in actually inviting one to share the rest of their life with you and be devoted to you, and from the standpoint of the female, for accepting such an invitation. People change. We probably changed ourselves somewhat significantly in life. And sometimes people change radically. They, in fact, become a different person through the course and the experiences of life. We're being asked to make judgments where emotions can cloud the issue. We talked about that a little bit in a sermon 2 weeks ago. But emotions and rationality tend to be on opposite sides of the spectrum, and we somehow have to work through emotions that may be taking us in a wrong direction relative to this decision of who we should spend the rest of our lives with. False objectives enter into the picture. Sometimes we marry for the wrong reason. We do not clarify well in our minds why it is that we're undergoing this deliberation process in the first place. And sometimes one marries, usually the female, to save someone else. In other words, she might marry someone who is troubled and even defective in some way because there's this nurturing desire to lift another person up from where they are to a higher plane. And that's not a wrong objective by any means, but it's not the objective of marrying someone. We should not marry someone in order to save them. Sometimes we marry out of sympathy or pity for someone. Certainly it's not wrong to feel those kinds of feelings for someone disadvantaged or troubled in some way, but marriage is not necessarily the outcome of that sympathy or that pity for another person. Sometimes people marry to get away from their parents. Sometimes they marry to cover up their sexual proclivities. There are all kinds of false reasons for which people marry. And so working through those, both in ourselves and in the one we're considering marrying, can be a very difficult and a very convoluted process. So as difficult as it is, as fraught with sobriety relative to the effect of the rest of our lives, how do we increase our chances of marrying for life and being happy and being fulfilled and being supplied in that marriage and marrying someone who allows us to supply for them what is needed? How do we increase the odds, as it were, in making this particular choice in life? Well, where does the world look? I think there's a lot of instruction, there's a lot of wisdom in considering the wrong way or the wrong places to look for a potential mate. And all we have to do is open our eyes to society and see how it's done in society. We'll say something about that in a minute. But before we do that, let's open the Scriptures and look and see where those of the world have searched for mates before and what the outcome of that was. Genesis chapter 6, the reading that we had just a while ago. Keep in mind that what is being described here in the early history of man is being told from a patriarchal point of view. That is, the early genealogies that we find are being told from the standpoint of the patriarch, the male. And Blaine, before he read, mentioned in chapter 5, not only the ages of the patriarchs who were living at that time, but what else has been done at this point is we have two basic lines of humanity being traced, the sons of Cain and the sons of Seth. Essentially, those that are respectful and aware of God and those that become very humanistic in their thinking. And so in Genesis chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. They had a choice to make. Just like those that are single may or may not, but we're assuming may in this sermon, may choose for themselves who to marry. Now, boy, commentators go into outer space on this one, almost literally. And we get all kinds of explanations like angels coming down, those being the sons of God, intermarrying with human beings, the daughters of men, creating this class or race of super giants, and they become depraved in their thinking, blah, blah, blah. That is so foreign to the context, it's laughable. It's so estranged from the whole purpose of what is being described here. The development of mankind is being described. It's being described from a patriarchal position. That is, it's male dominant. And what the writer of Genesis, presumably Moses, is doing is establishing the early wickedness of man leading to God destroying mankind through the flood. But what I want you to see is what Moses attributes a large portion of this wickedness to early on. He attributes it to bad moral choices in who to marry. The sons of God, righteous men, God-fearing men, saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful. The standards, the superficial standards and the emotions that enter into this decision-making process that so often lead us astray, these things are not new and they're not unique to our society. They've been as long as man has been. And beauty and physical attractiveness are not necessarily to be ignored in this decision-making process. It is quite natural for men and women to look at each other and evaluate them in terms of whatever the standard of beauty may be at that point in time. And that's the interesting thing about it is it's so culturally based. Go back and look at some Renaissance painting. Maybe I shouldn't suggest that. Some of it's not worth looking at. But if you were to come across some Renaissance painting, you will see that standards for what passed for beautiful in the 15 and 1600s is quite different from the standards of today. And yet our culture so often presses us into this mold and creates within us, almost unconsciously, creates within us a sense of what is beautiful or what is not beautiful. And what kind of emotions beauty can spark within us. And I don't want to appear to be naive in some of these things that we're thinking about relative to establishing, in this case, a marriage and a home. But I offer these things to help us keep them in perspective. Beauty and attractiveness are not to be ignored. They can't be ignored. But we do have the ability to keep them in perspective. We do not have to follow the cultural line. and so overemphasize the superficial and the physical to the point we make the wrong choice on the wrong basis and then perhaps suffer spiritually and even eternally for that wrong decision. The sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. Isn't it interesting? That's what Moses or the author, that's what is focused on. They saw that they were beautiful and took for themselves of all whom they chose. And immediately, God begins talking about judgment. Because this moral intermixing, this spiritual incompatibility led to an outbreak of wickedness. In verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Let me ask you this question. When the sons of God, righteous men, married the humanistic daughters, sons of God married the daughters of men, which force won out? Which one overcame the other and dominated? Goodness was diluted, and the influence of evil was stronger. It may not be so in every individual case, but I tend to think, based on this passage and other things that we might observe in the Scriptures, that oftentimes with best intentions present, the evil influence wins out. In spite of what we tell ourselves, and in spite of what we intend to happen, if there's moral and spiritual incompatibility, oftentimes the evil is the stronger of the forces. And so rampant wickedness broke out on the face of the earth to the point that God judged the whole world and saved, as you know, only a handful at a time of extreme wickedness. Well, as we study later on in the book of Genesis, we come to a man named Esau. And in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 16, Esau is described as being profane. In fact, you're going to turn to Genesis 26. We'll read from there in just a moment. Esau is described later on as a man who is profane. And that word basically means he was irreligious and unspiritual in his outlook on life. This is what led Esau to sell his birthright because he was hungry. He was just overwhelmed by his physical passions, in that case, just hunger. And he was led to make a decision on that basis rather than any deeper spiritual basis, that is, that he might become the patriarchal leader of the family, having received the birthright and the blessing from his father, Isaac. But he bartered that away for a bowl of soup, as it were. But you see, this kind of decision-making carries on in the life of Esau. In Genesis 26, in verses 34 and 35, when Esau was 40 years old, he took as wives Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. Again, when marriages are contracted in our day and time to the displeasure of parents, it isn't a modern phenomenon. It happened a long, long time ago, and Esau chooses to marry outside of the line of people that God is developing for spiritual blessing to come on the face of the earth. And he marries two Hittite women. They become a grief to his parents. In Genesis 28, verses 8 and 9. Also, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac. This is in the aftermath of Jacob being sent away under the pretense of finding a wife. It's actually to keep Esau from killing him. But Rebekah uses this as a pretext to suggest to Isaac, maybe we should send Jacob off. After all, look what Esau has chosen. And so Jacob is going to be sent back to the family connections, to Laban, to find a wife. Esau saw the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac, so Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife in addition to the wife he had. Perhaps later I can hear from some of you on this. I think there's an ambiguity in verse 9. I'm not quite sure if Esau did this to spite further his parents, or this was Esau's way of trying to mend the fences but still didn't accomplish it. I mean, in the end, you end up in the same place. Esau marries outside the favor of his parents. But again, is he trying to tweak their nose one more time in marrying after Ishmael? Or is he trying to make amends, but he just is so profane he doesn't know how to do it? So, you know, as people will do, they try to do something spiritual, but they don't quite get there. You know, it may be that they do something religious, but it still isn't in keeping with the will of God. Esau marries someone from an Abrahamic line, Ishmael, but it is not the true line that God has selected for blessings to come to all men through. And here's the point about Esau. Let's relate it to his choice of marriage and then compare it to his choice of selling his birthright. We're also told that later Esau wanted to change his mind regarding what he had decided on carnal ground, and he couldn't do it. And it might be that if we make a decision on whom to marry on carnal grounds, on the wrong set of standards, it very well may be we come to a point where we would like a do-over. We would like to have that choice back, and we can't get it back. Because we've married for life, we've committed ourselves before God and those witnesses present on that day, we've committed ourselves to remain one with that person, and there is no go back. It's a statement my grandmother used to make a lot. When she wanted to emphasize a point, she'd say, and there ain't no go back on that. And there ain't no go back on that. Not on this decision. And if there is another chance, it usually comes through a lot of pain. Well, then we have the example in Hosea chapter 1 of a prophet of God marrying someone unsuitable. This time it's interesting, though. God commanded him to do this. Now, God didn't command Hosea to make a sinful marriage. But the choice to where God directs Hosea does result in an unhappy marriage and adultery being committed in that marriage. Hosea chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. When the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord. I take it that the likely reference there is not to take a prostitute, but take someone of the children of Israel who by and large have been influenced by this time by idolatry. Now, fornication and adultery was part and parcel with idolatry. But I think what God's directing Hosea to do is go take a wife who has been formed and influenced by the culture of the day. Isn't this interesting? Quite the opposite of what happened with Adam. God gave Adam a perfect mate, suitable to him in all ways. God says to Hosea, in essence, I want you to understand what's been done to me. You take a wife that's been influenced by the culture, the idolatrous culture. And Hosea has children with her. And later on, we find that she does become unfaithful. And God says to Hosea, I want you to go take her back. What a painful process this would have been for this prophet. And even though it's at God's bidding, there is a lesson to be learned in regard to making a choice that is going to be a wise and a balanced choice in who we marry. Well, there are other examples we could look at in the Scriptures. Political marriages that ended up being disastrous. They were made on the wrong foundation. David and Michael, the daughter of Saul. Ahab and Jezebel. Hard to imagine one worse than that one. Herod, Antipas, and Herodias in the New Testament. Marriages founded essentially on sand because they really weren't contracted on spiritual or moral principles with the ultimate design of marriage that God had in mind for man. But again, marrying under false pretenses or marrying for the wrong reasons, marrying as a business contract or a political contract rather than two souls being bound together to help the other one live in a way that would be godly, which is essentially, I think, what God wants us to do when we choose who to marry. Well, if worldly people were looking in all the wrong places for marriage partners, then what about today? Well, the same thing is happening, perhaps in a little bit of a different social context. But we can look around at the world, friends and acquaintances and co-workers and whatnot, and we can see the kinds of choices that people are making, and we can see where people are looking. And I'll tell you, if I was a worldly person, if I didn't have any regard for God, and I was having to make this choice of finding someone to marry that I could trust, that I could serve, that I could have confidence in, boy, where would I look? Where would you find someone of principle if you really had very little or no regard for God? And so we see people looking in all the wrong places. They're looking in bars, they're looking in nightclubs, they're looking at parties, perhaps invited to. Some are turning to dating services. Mutual friends are very commonly a source of making contacts. Chat rooms on the internet, which are very dangerous. At the office, at school, etc., etc. So many of these venues that the world is looking in for mates emphasize what is the shallowest in the human being. Having fun, having a good time, exciting the physical elements. And those people are looking in those places because those are the standards often that they have. And those are the things that they, that's the itch they want to have scratched. And so they're looking in the places where they're going to potentially find that kind of a mate. I was preaching along this same line one time several years ago. And I was rebuked by one of the Christian women after the sermon because I had said that nightclubs are not an appropriate place to be searching for a mate, and she and her husband had met in a nightclub. And so she was upset that I was suggesting that nightclubs are absolutely the wrong places to be looking for a potential mate because the woman had been raised in a Christian home, the man had not, both had married, and at that time, at least, were attempting to live a life of faith. And so she was somewhat offended that I had said that nightclubs are a poor place to meet. Listen, chance meetings may work out anywhere. It may be, as in my personal case, you're not even looking. And you're not in a place where you might expect to find someone, and you're going to meet someone. Chance meetings that lead to marriages that may work out certainly happen. However, that is not to recommend the place or the circumstance that one may have met in. You can't recommend nightclubs, even though a marriage may succeed where the people met in the nightclub. That is not a venue, generally speaking, for meeting quality people, not morally and spiritually. Secondly, let me suggest to you and to the sister of old here, it was in spite of meeting in the nightclub that the marriage worked, not because of it. The nightclub didn't add to the soundness of the relationship that they were embarking on. So let's be careful that we don't draw the false conclusion. Just because it works doesn't mean it's recommended. And we began the lesson by saying, where are we going to look to increase our chances of a marriage working in the end? And, you know, basically that's what we're facing. In spite of surgery, wouldn't it have been nice, you know, for God to be handing to Adam a being where God has decided this is the person you need? Even then, that was not perfect in the end because of this thing we call human will, self-determination, because Eve did not end up fulfilling the entire purpose that God had for her relative to Adam. there's no equation here that we can plug in all the right numbers and spit out the absolute answer in the end. That's just not the way things work here on the earth. We can raise our odds, as it were. We can improve our chances. But at the end of the day, we're making a decision for life and for eternal consequences based on the changeableness of human beings. The world looks in the wrong places as a reflection of its standards and values. And I suggest to you that's what's going to happen when Christians begin to look for mates as well. This is not a dating service. I'm not offering you, real life suggestions on where to look. This is a spiritual lesson with spiritual objectives. And what I'm going to say to you is that we need as Christians to be looking in the places that increase our chances of finding someone who has the values that we know are foundational to marriage. I know where that's probably not going to happen. I can't tell you where it will happen. And that really isn't the issue. The issue is, how am I looking? And with what standards am I looking? And I'll tell you, that's going to determine probably where you look. In fact, it's got really probably more to do with the seeker than the one being sought. We might worry and wonder, be turning to 1 Corinthians 7, page 771 in the Pew Bible. 1 Corinthians 7. We may, who are still single, be so worried about the other person and finding the other person. And it might be that the focus really needs to be on the searcher and making sure that everything is proper and in place and balanced and perspectives are clear, priorities are well arranged, first and foremost. Then let the process work itself out. I'll say something more about that in a minute. However, I want to notice with you 1 Corinthians 7, verses 32 and 33. In this chapter, Paul is writing about marriage. He's writing about a legitimate element of marriage early on, being that of physical satisfaction. He's writing about divorce in various situations and what to do and not to do in that case. And whether to marry or not in the first place, given the present distress that he's writing about, that he introduces later in the chapter. But it's in that context, this whatever it was, this circumstance that made marriage a little bit dodgy in Corinth at that time, whether persecution or whatever. But it was a delicate matter then, as it is now, to find someone to marry because of these external circumstances. But anyway, look at verse 32. But I want you to be without care, is why Paul is advising them as he is. He who is unmarried, watch this, he who is unmarried cares for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. And that certainly describes Paul's life. He speaks of being single himself in the early part of the chapter. And he says, I wish all men were like myself, not having a burning desire to marry so that they could focus themselves more on the things of God. But if you are single and searching, let me urge you to focus for a while on verse 32. Does that describe your singleness? That in your singleness and while you're searching for a mate or with searching for a mate in view in your future, if you're 16, 17, 18 years old, you're still looking down the road at that process. Let me ask you, would verse 32 describe your unmarried life? That is, that you are focused on things that belong to the Lord and how you may please the Lord. Because, I'll tell you this, when you marry, that's going to change. Not your loyalties necessarily, but your attention and the time, your energy is going to become divided. Which is what he says in verse 33. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. So in verse 32, we've got the single life, which is focused on God. We've got the married life, which is of a divided focus, but not loyalty. God is still first, but the life is more divided. Obligations are now increased and more complicated. I'm now dividing my time and energy and effort between my mate and the Lord. Now, what he says in verse 33, he's not talking about sinful distraction. He's talking about that which just is naturally so. If I'm single, I can devote myself to study more intensively. I can devote myself to being with the brethren in different opportunities and different circumstances. I can provide more of my energy and skill and talent to the local church. With being married comes family obligations that will dilute that. Here's what I want you to think about in this regard. I think the first element really helps us define the second. That is, how we're living as a single person and what we're focused on as a single person is going to greatly impact how we handle that divided relationship in verse 33, that one of marriage, where I now have a wife to consider, or vice versa, I'm a wife with a husband to consider. So in my singleness and in my searching and in my deliberation about being married as a future proposition, am I as focused on the Lord now as I should be? Have I prioritized my own life as well as the standards that I'm going to use to evaluate a potential mate? Have I evaluated that properly? Have I prioritized it properly? So that when I find that person I'm looking for, I do not compromise the loyalty to God. That is, while I was single, I put the Lord where He belonged. And I learned and conditioned myself to think first spiritually and put God first in all things. Thus, when I married, I didn't change that. God still came first in all things, but that set the context for me serving my husband or serving my wife in a way that did not persuade me to compromise my loyalty to God. If this is the kind of outlook that we might have as a single person, let me suggest, I think that will in itself lead us to look for a mate in places where we should be looking. And that doesn't necessarily mean at worship service. It doesn't necessarily mean at Florida College. It doesn't necessarily mean at a Bible study or using a Christian dating service. It may. I may meet my mate at Florida College, or I may meet at a worship service somewhere, or I may meet through a Christian dating service. There's more of those beginning to pop up where, and I don't want to go too far afield here, but I think somebody here is married having met through one of those services where Christians were put in contact with other Christians. It may happen that way. It may not. The issue here is less one of venue, unless it's a wicked venue. It's less one of venue and more one of, who am I as a searcher? Who am I as a seeker? The issue perhaps can be boiled down to having clearly defined standards and goals so that we are looking in the best places and we're being helped by the best people, we're advised by the best wisdom in the search that we're undergoing, one of the most basic and long-reaching decisions that we'll make in this life. And while Melanie and I didn't meet in an expected place or way, we did have good people, her grandmother and my mother, who were, yes, matchmaking, but we had good people, and we were looking in good places. And hopefully, if not ours, the judgment of others around us was good judgment. If you'll forgive me the personal illustration. But it's not so much where. It's who. And the basic challenge, really, that we're trying to deal with here is, what kind of person is this other person? Hopefully I've clarified that for myself and I've done it on the proper grounds. And now I'm trying to figure out, not one that satisfies all these superficial and carnal issues, but what kind of person is this? And is it the kind of person that's going to help me in my spirituality, that I can help in theirs, that we can help each other mutually on this, the most important thing, and that's the walk that we're engaged in together through this life toward heaven. Well, let's just notice some quick application points and then we'll close the sermon. Number one, clarify your standards, both for yourself, but in a potential mate. Where are those standards centered? Are they cultural? Are they superficial? Do they emphasize the carnal and the emotional rather than the deeper issues of morality and spirituality? Search for a moral and spiritual compatibility. In fact, in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, looking briefly, this is the passage that talks about being unequally yoked. And I don't necessarily think that the passage here is speaking of Christian and a non-Christian on the face of it being an arrangement that God wouldn't acknowledge. I think that is addressed to some degree in 1 Corinthians 7. But I do think what's being suggested here is that when there is a union that takes place between a Christian and a non-Christian, and the evil begins to dominate, that is, there is an unequal yoking together of righteousness and unrighteousness, not merely an association, but the righteousness begins to be diluted. In that case, there is an unequal yoking together that should not be happening. And I wish I could say to you that I've seen more Christians pull up non-Christians than the opposite. But I think the opposite is generally true. That it's the faith and the strength of the Christian that is compromised in the process. In that case, I think 2 Corinthians 6 applies. There's an unequal yoking together that should not be. But the objective that ought to be in the forefront of our minds, if we're spiritual and moral people with eternal objectives in mind, is searching for someone that shares that. That seems to me to be common sense. Look to someone who can share the deepest values and desires and objectives that we hold dear ourselves. Handle parental disapproval wisely. Esau didn't, and it's not often handled well today on both sides. Sometimes the parents don't handle it well when the son or the daughter is heading maritally in a direction that they don't approve of. Sometimes it can get downright ugly. And then sometimes that begins to cloud the issue of those who are considering marrying. And I'll tell you, this is a very difficult line to draw. It's a matter of judgment, and it's very, very difficult how much disapproval to manifest, certainly what attitude it's manifested. And for those that are marrying and there's parental disapproval, to be careful that that doesn't become the issue, and I'll marry him in spite of it, or I'll marry him to show that it's my decision and I'll do what I want to do. Very often, this choice does not involve only ourselves. That's a separate point coming. But it involves others around us. And how we handle this disapproval, if in fact it comes, can affect the marriage greatly. Marrying in conflict with family standards will produce stress and alienation. So if we go down that path, we simply need to accept this is what's going to happen. If I'm marrying someone that is so very much at odds with the standards of my family, and maybe those standards are unfairly imposed, but I'm more here talking about moral and spiritual standards. If we're making a choice that violates everything that our parents have always stood for, we may as well just accept the fact it's going to be a rocky road. Again, this is a matter that's got to be handled very carefully, and there's There's not an easy solution to it, but all sides must be looking spiritually and morally at the issue. The consequences of who we marry will affect many others, not just ourselves, and for a long time to come. Our children are going to be affected. Potentially, our interaction with the brethren is going to be affected. We've had someone recently make a public statement to that effect in their lives. That who they married affected them and their relationship with their brethren. And so it's a matter to be considered. The ramifications, the ripples that go out from this decision are often lifetime ripples, and they go into places that we would not expect. And so the issue is certainly more than just the two people involved in making the decision. Finally, pray and work on ourselves and our own priorities, our own spiritual outlook. Pray that God's providence might provide a compatible mate for us at the right time of life. I think I've been guilty looking back of probably wishing in violation of both of those things. There are others in the past that I'd considered marrying, and looking back, it probably would not have been a good thing. There are times in life I thought I was ready to be married, and looking back, I wasn't. And so, perhaps I'm not that unusual. Perhaps we all should be looking toward the providence of God and asking God to help us with this difficult and sometimes conflicted decision that we're trying to make. And let me close with this particular thought. If we're working on being the kind of person that God would have us to be, we're also working on being the kind of person that another spiritually minded person would be looking for. In other words, be the person that would be a blessing to someone else who is godly and spiritual. Do I have the confidence that someone else could look at me and say, that person could get me to heaven? Help me get to heaven. That person will enhance my faith. That person will strengthen my knowledge. That person will help me raise children in a way that they would also have a chance to go to heaven. That's the kind of person that would help enhance my spirituality. Is that the kind of person you are becoming? Is that the kind of person you are looking for? The world isn't choosing well. And sometimes I've seen brethren not choose well. And the consequences will be the same in either case. May we be focused on the spiritual things and keep them in priority as we undertake this most important search. I heard just part of a radio survey the other morning. I may not have gotten the whole thing, but I got at least part of it. The survey was informal, not scientific poll. Would you marry the same person over again? 80% of men said that they would. Only 50% of the women said they would. Ouch. Are you the kind of person that your mate would say, I'd marry them again? Because they're helping me get to heaven. They're helping me learn about God. They're helping enhance my spirituality. They're trustworthy. They're dependable. They're devoted and loyal. And I have that confidence in that person. Is that the character that either you're wanting to bring to your marriage not yet established, or is that what you're bringing to the marriage that you're already in? Most important marriage, though, is the one with Christ. Later on in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul talks about betrothing them as a chaste virgin unto Christ. Really, I think this ensuring the soundness of our marriages and building on the most solid foundation begins with being a Christian, which is obviously the foundation of everything else that's worthwhile in this life. So we're going to sing a song. It's a song of invitation and encouragement to you. If you're here this morning and not fully committed to the Lord, you may be married, you may not yet be married, but I hope that you see and you've come to dwell upon the importance of being in union with Christ as the basis for all else in your life, including your marriage. Can we help you obey the gospel and to establish that relationship with Christ? Is there some missing piece of that puzzle that we can help you with this morning? If so, would you come as we stand and sing?